Hello, and welcome to episode number 103 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. When we take the time to look back at the history of the UFO phenomenon in popular culture, perhaps no book has had an impact greater than Whitley Strieber's groundbreaking 1987 work, Communion. This was a book that, on the one hand, caught the world by surprise, depicting shocking, discombobulating encounters with beings of a decidedly otherworldly nature, despite the fact that the experiences seemed to be happening, at least partially, very much in physical reality, and were experienced not just by Strieber, but also by his family and by guests to his cabin in upstate New York. While shocking in its claims, one can easily make the argument that the reason the book had such an impact on popular culture is the fact that so many people resonated with the material within. And even more pointedly, with the now iconic cover of the book, depicting what has since become known as the quintessential gray alien. The being depicted on the front cover of Communion was not only provocative, but also, to many thousands of people around the world, strangely familiar. Of course, the question that inevitably arises from this fact is, why? Were these apparent memory fragments suggestive of a reality where untold numbers of human beings were being abducted in a similar manner to Strieber? And if so, what was the nature of the apparently extensive enterprise these beings were in the midst of conducting? Perplexingly, while elements of the encounters seemed to be happening in something like an alternate state of consciousness or in an alternate ethereal realm, other elements involving medical examinations and the extraction of reproductive genetic material seem suggestive of a much more down-to-earth purpose, perhaps involving the hybridization program that has become such a linchpin of our contemporary understanding of the phenomenon. These questions were of paramount importance in 1987, when this book was first unleashed upon the world. Since then, the significance of the material has only become even more pressing, as many of the future visions experiencers like Strieber had then have seemingly come to pass, suggesting we are even closer to some consequential turning point in human history, a moment these beings spoke so pointedly about. Because to be clear, the encounters did involve warnings that seem particularly prescient in light of how things have unfolded in human civilization since the time of Strieber's initial encounters. But, we might ask, to what end, and in preparation for what? Who are these beings, and how are their efforts to not only interact with us, but perhaps even via the hybridization program, to chart a new evolutionary path forward, related to the events arising in our midst even as we speak? Events that threaten our very place on the planet as we have known it. These are just a few of the questions we'll seek to engage with in this, the 103rd episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I just want to point out that if you'd like to support this podcast and my work, and in so doing, gain access to all of my content, which includes not just POC and Liminal Frames and Event Horizon, but also the various feature material I create, as well as archived material, including the first 50 episodes of Point of Convergence, as well as early access and discounts to online classes and retreats, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, with that preamble aside, let's move on to today's episode topic. We're going to be discussing Whitley Strieber's groundbreaking book, Communion, as well as what we've learned since then that provides additional context on those encounters as they are recorded in that paradigm-changing work. I also want to make note of the fact that this book particularly, was my introduction to this topic. Soon after I finished high school, I came across this book and was completely taken by it and the material within. And in fact, it wasn't just this book. I remember also gobbling up his follow-up books, including Transformation, Breakthrough, and The Secret School, which was published somewhat later. I really wish I still had those original versions of those books. But alas, because I've moved around a lot since I first read those books, somewhere in the shuffle, they were lost. Now, as I said in the introduction, what is unique about this book is the impact it had upon the human populace. And again, not just because it's shocking in its claims, but because many of the claims seem somewhat familiar to people, buried perhaps deep in their subconscious. And of course, even more prominent than that was people's reaction to the front cover of this book, as I mentioned in the introduction. Again, it's not that people thought, a gray alien, some non-human being, as if encountering it for the very first time. They specifically felt a sense of knowing with this being, as if they had come across this being at some point in their history, even if, again, it was now lodged in the murky depths of their subconscious. And of course, importantly, if that sense of familiarity represented something real, as if many, many people have actually encountered these kinds of beings, then perhaps this suggests there is a much more extensive program underway where aliens, apparently alien beings, are interacting with human beings, and even, again, more specifically, gathering genetic material as part of some ongoing hybridization program of a massive scale. These were the implications if these memory fragments many thousands of people around the world experienced actually pointed to something real. All right, having remarked upon the cultural significance of this book, let's now jump into the material. I first want to go to the introduction to the 2022 edition of this book. It was recently reissued with a new introduction from Strieber himself. And of course, that's interesting because it allows him to reflect on what has changed and what hasn't changed in the decades since he first published this book. He writes, quote, "Since Communion was published in October of 1987, there has been a significant advance in how we understand the presence that most people think of as aliens. In recent years, this advance has accelerated steadily. We are right at the edge of official admission that somebody is here, and along with it, acceptance of this as a fact. But who, or should that be, what? When Communion was written, somebody claiming alien contact was publicly called a liar or pitied as being mentally disturbed. I experienced both reactions. Only, more or less in secret, and to my great surprise, something else happened. As soon as the book was published, there was an explosion of interest. Derided and suppressed though it was, contact between human beings and the entities I had begun to call the visitors was not only happening, it was proving to be more widespread than anybody realized. And yet, due to social engineering of some kind, possibly originating with government agencies that had realized what was going on and also understood that they were powerless to stop it, the entire culture, from science and academia to the man on the street, was being led to believe that it was all lies and craziness. Prior to publishing this book, I'd had a career as a novelist, with the publication of War Day in 1983, which was an acclaimed novelistic attempt to warn of the dangers of so-called limited nuclear war. My literary reputation had reached a high point, and now here I was claiming that I'd had contact with aliens. Worse, some of my early books had been horror novels, and the intellectual and literary communities now forgot about War Day and rushed to say that Communion was also a horror novel, a clever hoax designed to deceive the public and fill my pockets with cash. Our many literary friends disappeared from our lives. I became a pariah. My wife a social outcast. Throughout his school years, our son was relentlessly bullied and persecuted. As for the media, they gave me a hearing, but in the process, more or less, ate me for lunch." He goes on to say, quote, "Starting in 2017, with an article in the New York Times, Glowing Auras and Black Money, the Pentagon's Mysterious UFO Program, by Helene Cooper, Ralph Blumenthal, and Leslie Kane, revealing that the U.S. Navy was in possession of video of aerial objects that were not of known origin, elements of the U.S. government have been admitting that we are not alone. Further revelations by Pentagon insider Luis Elizondo have made it clear that they have been aware of this for years. With the release of yet more radar tracks and pilot reports, even the most recalcitrant scientists and academics have begun to at least stop rejecting the idea that an intelligence might be behind the objects or even in them, unquote. So there we see the bookmark between two key periods in our history. When he first published this book in 1987, even though it captured public attention, he was basically eaten alive by academia, by scientists, and even by his literary friends, his literary community. But he noticed again in 2017 there was a significant change when the government began to finally acknowledge that there were unknowns in our sky and at least opened the question to the possibility of their origin being non-human. Now, something else that Struber touches upon in this new introduction to the 2022 edition is the fact that not only is this not derided and scoffed at as much as was the case in the late 1980s when his encounters happened, but in addition, we've actually seen academia, scientists and whatnot, begin to look to studying this phenomenon. And that begins by looking at the people who've had these experiences and not assuming that they are simply crazy or making up stories, but actually looking at their brain structures to see if there's something that hints at what might be going on here, and at least a connection between certain kinds of people and the fact that they had these certain kinds of experiences. And this relates to the so-called caudate putamen, a part of the brain that scientists have keyed in on in trying to understand this. And touching on this, Struber writes, quote, "Over the past few years, a small group of neurologists and biologists obtained access from close encounter witnesses to their medical records in order to study their brains. They soon found that some such witnesses had abnormally dense connections between two brain areas, the caudate and the putamen. These brain areas, collectively called the striatum, are critical parts of its executive function and are involved in cognition and perception. In 2022, a doctor who was involved in the program examined my 2014 MRI scan. He reported to me as follows. The caudate putamen connections are at the density of upper normal. While the density bilaterally are upper normal, the white matter connections are unique in my experience. They're very distinct, more than I have ever seen. They are highly non-striatial and not running parallel in any plane. Non-striatial means that they are not striped gray and white matter as is seen in other brains. This could indicate some unknown functionality, perhaps related to perception. Was something done to my brain when the needle was inserted into my head, which over the years caused this change? Or was this already present and not commented on by the earlier radiologist because it doesn't appear to be a pathology? Unfortunately, we cannot know, nor can we know whether or not the unusual structures in my and other brains somehow facilitates the encounter experience." Unquote. Indeed, so here again we have kind of a chicken versus egg kind of scenario where these differences in brain structures are noted, but it's unclear at this point whether or not these have been produced by the encounters, perhaps even by some sort of augmentation process that takes place during the medical examinations, or if these were already that way and somehow the aliens or whatever they are, this non-human intelligence, or at least this non-conventionally human intelligence, we'll touch on that later, somehow knew this about these people, and that's why they picked these particular people for something to do with their enterprise. Again, that remains to be seen, but we should at least acknowledge this progress that the medical community, neurologists and whatnot, are looking into these potential biomarkers as we speak. As we've already discussed, most of the encounters that Struber recounts in this book happened in the 1980s, and really just shortly before he actually began penning this book, trying to make sense of these encounters. But what he found in regression hypnosis, which again, other experiencers have also found, is that some encounters came up from the deep subconscious from much earlier in his life, from his childhood indeed. And again, this is something else we find, a trend we find amongst experiencers. On another podcast episode of POC, I mentioned Robert Hastings. He was someone who for years was going around to college campuses before the internet was really much of a thing, trying to raise awareness about UFOs and nuclear facilities, trying to just make that nuts and bolts connection for people and pointing out the paramount importance of that fact. Only much later, decades later, in his 50s, I think, did he begin to have memories of encounters with beings when he was a child. Again, what's remarkable is he'd steered clear of the experiencer community, didn't want to pollute his message with accounts of supposedly strange beings and human interactions with them. He didn't want to muddy the empirical data of the fact that UFOs were showing up over nuclear facilities and sometimes shutting down silos with supposedly subjective accounts from people who may or may not have had encounters with beings. He didn't want to mess with that at all. But of course, that began to change when much later in life, he began to have memories himself of having encounters with these beings. And what that raises in Strieber's case, in Hastings' case, as well as in other people's case, including my own and Mike Masters, who I'm going to mention later in this episode, is the fact that the very paths we take are to some degree directed or at least seeded with intention by these beings beginning in childhood. And again, that changes the course of people's lives. And again, this all being connected to some consequential moment, which is fast approaching human civilization as we speak. So let's jump back into the book where Strieber recounts not only his experiences from the 1980s, but also when this earlier memory began to surface during hypnotic regression. Quote, "In Communion, I describe five contact events, four of which I experienced over 1985 and 1986, and one when I was 12 years old in 1957. I believe that actual physical events were involved in all of them. For three of them, this is because there were witnesses who were never directly involved in the encounter itself, but who did in some way notice it as it happened. Of the latter, there are two, and my reasons for believing them to be true are because, as incredible as they are, many other people spontaneously reported similar ones in the letters we received after Communion was published, long before such things were generally known." I'm going to jump forward to when he talks about his much earlier encounter as a child. Quote, "As to the fourth event, which was my sudden return to the age of 12 during my hypnosis covering the December 26th abduction, I think that it probably means that something must have happened to me while I was a little boy that traumatized me in the same way as did the 1985 abduction. Whether or not the description of this childhood event, being abducted with my father and sister from aboard a moving train, is accurate or not, I cannot be sure. The Secret School, the book I wrote in an effort to recover childhood memories, contains just enough corroboration to suggest that some unusual things may have happened. As far as any childhood experiences are concerned, until that moment in Dr. Klein's office, I remembered nothing whatsoever about them. The only reason he even asked me my age was that he noticed a tone in my voice that suggested that I had gone back to an earlier time in my life, something that he had observed with abuse victims. As to why anybody would forget something so extraordinary as a visit from aliens, my son, now in his 40s, doesn't remember anything about the childhood experience he described to us so extensively, and which, in two cases, I actually saw happen." Unquote. And in reflecting on what we discussed earlier with the subconscious memories that were perhaps surfacing when many, many people saw the front cover of this book, again, this speaks to the fact that these events can be buried in the subconscious, even though they really did happen, even though there is corroborating evidence to establish the fact that they happened in physical reality. And that, again, makes us wonder how many people, perhaps thousands, perhaps millions, have had these very kinds of encounters and just don't have it as part of their conscious memory. Now, something I've remarked on many times on this podcast is how this topic leaves no other topic unscathed, how this becomes kind of like a gateway drug to an unraveling of reality as we have known it. This changes everything, our understanding of our history, of our future, of our origins, of the nature of life and death, and the very fabric of reality itself. Now, Strieber, along with his wife Anne, who is now passed on, even though, again, Strieber had ongoing interactions with her even after she moved on, learned about this connection between the living and the dead, and specifically the beings and the dead. They seem to show up with the dead, the human dead, very often, which seemed to point to the fact that they somehow had a cross-domain capacity, or perhaps even more importantly, pointed to the fact that this hardline division we assume is the case is actually largely illusory. And Strieber talks about one of these kinds of encounters in this book as well. A quote from the book again, quote, "The fifth event involved me seeing an old friend sitting with the visitors in the woods during the moments before I went flying up into their craft. Of all things, he carefully explained to me that the exhaust manifolds on the then top secret stealth aircraft were defective and would lead to crashes of the test aircraft. And then he notes, in July of 1986, an F-117 did crash near Bakersfield, California. As he had been a CIA officer, I thought perhaps that I had been drugged, which had caused me to see all these weird creatures. I thought this because I'd published a book called War Day a few years before, which had angered some powerful political figures, and I'd been warned by one Senate staffer that such people weren't above playing quote-unquote dirty tricks. In any case, I phoned him. His number was disconnected. I then called his brother and got a shock. My friend had died the previous March, so I decided that whatever had happened, it hadn't involved him. I left it out of the original book. Even now, I would assume either that it was a misperception on my part or something that they had tricked me into believing, except for what has happened since. As has become clearer and clearer over the years, this whole immense phenomenon has almost certainly also to do with what we think of as the human dead, who are not supposed to exist at all. In fact, in order to study it effectively, we are going to have to revise the understanding of reality that has emerged in Western thought since the Age of Reason began in the 18th century. I don't think that we are ever going to need to say that some sort of quote-unquote supernatural is real, but rather that there is a significant part of the natural world and our own presence in it that we do not yet understand as part of objective reality, but rather only in terms of stories of gods, angels, demons, ghosts, and so forth, unquote. Something else that we've discussed many times on this podcast, as well as on Liminal Frames, is how people's understanding, perception of this phenomenon changes over time, and how experiencers go from ontological shock and really wishing these encounters were not happening to actually, for many of them, actually embracing these encounters and welcoming how it opens a new understanding of reality itself, as well as a depth of understanding of the human soul. And indeed, Strieber also went through this transformation, and he discusses this in this next section. Quote, "Over the 30-plus years since my abduction, I have gone from being outraged and terrified to learning how to engage with our visitors in ways that are useful and enriching to me. The relationship that started in the depths of hell for me now unfolds at the flickering edge of heaven. This awful thing that overturned my life completely has become the most valuable resource in terms of the growth of knowledge, psyche, and spirit that I can imagine. In short, I have made my relationship work, and fortunately, I am not alone. Many of us, starting out as I did, have come to similar results. Not all, of course, but many." Unquote. Now, we should note that that reflection came with perspective and time. That reflection was authored decades after the initial encounters. In this next section, we're going to read from his initial reaction, what it was like and how overwhelming it was. And you'll notice a distinct difference in tone when he's first grappling with the encounters. Quoting now from the original version of the book, quote, "This is the story of one man's attempt to deal with a shattering assault from the unknown. It is a true story, as true as I know how to describe it. To all appearances, I have had an elaborate personal encounter with intelligent non-human beings. But who could they be, and where have they come from? Are unidentified flying objects real? Are there goblins or demons or visitors? At first, I thought I was losing my mind, but I was interviewed by three psychologists and three psychiatrists, given a battery of psychological tests and a neurological examination, and found to fall within the normal range in all respects. I was also given a polygraph by an operator with 30 years' experience, and I passed without qualification. I had been indifferent to the whole issue of unidentified flying objects and extraterrestrials. I had viewed them as a false unknown, easily explainable as misperceptions or hallucinations. Now, what was I to think? The visitors marched right into the middle of the life of an indifferent skeptic without a moment's hesitation. Later, I found a large number of people who have had experiences similar to mine. Most of them were mentally stable. They did not cluster in any particular population group, but formed a cross-section of American society. I have met, among many others, a scientist, a policeman, and a federal officer who have had encounters, unquote. And the key here is that in that early process of trying to metabolize these encounters, Strieber, along with pretty much every experiencer, questioned his own sanity. And again, it was in finding corroboration from other people who had had very similar encounters, recounting very similar elements, who did not know each other, who, like him, had no interest in the UFO phenomenon beforehand, and if anything, were perhaps dismissive of encounter claims. But when it happened to him, he was forced to reckon with it. And when he talked to others, he found similar elements and began, along with them, to recognize that this was somehow happening in physical reality, that this was very much, quote unquote, real. Now, in terms of the process experiencers go through to try to make sense of these encounters, very often they begin by assuming these are dreams. This is partly because the nature of the experiences seems somewhat dreamlike, and so that lets them believe that that could be the case. They also, of course, don't want to think this could be happening in physical reality, because that involves a loss of agency and a loss of sense of control altogether, and people do not want to face that, so it's simpler to keep it in the land of dreams. But unfortunately, that doesn't work so well, because eventually something arises, often a physical sensation or some sort of physical effect in people's physiology that makes it clear to them that something is real, something's happening beyond just in dreamlike states. And Strieber talks about this in this next section. Quote, "On the afternoon of January 3rd, we were skiing when I got a pain behind my right ear. It was a sensation similar to what happens to one's jaw when Novocaine wears off after a session in the dentist's chair. My skull ached and the skin was sensitive. In the middle of the sensitive area, my wife could see a tiny pinpoint of a scab. I believe that the combination of the infected finger, the rectal pain, and the aching head were what finally brought my memories into focus. The confused swirl resolved into a specific series of recollections, and when I saw what they were, I just about exploded with terror and utter disbelief. One of the memories would come into my head, linger there for a moment, then leave me with my heart pounding, gasping, sweat pouring down my face. I thought that I had lost my mind. For half of my life, I had been engaged in a rigorous and detailed search for a finer state of consciousness. Now I thought my mind was turning against me, that my years of eager study of everything from Zen to quantum physics had led me into some strange and tragic byway of the soul. As soon as I had them in focus, my memories became perfectly vivid, as vivid, say, as childhood memories become when one chooses to draw them out of the mental file where they are hidden. I sat at my desk trying to make sense of what could not make sense. I thought, quietly and calmly, you may be going mad, or you may have a brain tumor. You've got to find out which it is and take whatever steps are necessary. And then I rested my head on the desk and, quite frankly, cried. For a couple of days, I lived with it. Maybe the quote-unquote symptoms would subside. Then, quite suddenly, one afternoon, I recalled the smell. Their smell. It came back to me as clearly as if I had inhaled, if not one moment before. More than anything except discovering that I was not alone with my experience, that totally real memory saved me from going stark, raving, mad." Unquote. We're now going to explore a section of the book where Strieber goes into memories that were uncovered by way of hypnotic regression. Now, to be clear, this is a controversial method. Some people are for it, some people are against it. Again, as I've said before, I think it can be a powerfully effective tool when done right. And to be clear, not every hypnotic regressionist is equal in their skill in terms of how they conduct these regressions. So if you're thinking about it, ask around and find someone who is reputable. Now, Strieber himself wrestled with whether or not to do this, whether or not to engage in hypnotic regression to try to make sense, better sense, and perhaps uncover additional memories as part of his process. He writes, quote, "We just don't know enough about hypnosis to call it a completely trustworthy scientific tool in a situation like this. While Don Klein certainly didn't ask provocative questions, there is always the possibility that I was unconsciously eager to comply with an outcome that I might secretly have longed for. I might want powerful visitors to appear to save a world that I'm pretty sure is in serious trouble. I'd spent the past 3 years working on books about nuclear war and environmental collapse. I knew full well that we are going to have a really rough time in the next 50 years. Maybe the idea of visitors coming along and saving our necks was more appealing to me than I might consciously have wished to admit. Maybe I hid my desperation from myself in order to live and raise a child with anything like a happy heart." Unquote. Now, again, I would go a step deeper here and suggest that the concerns that Strieber had about nuclear war, about environmental collapse, were themselves seeded in part by these beings. Again, that's been part of my experience. It's been part of the experience of other people I've talked to, that the very things that motivate us in life have been seeded to some extent. And it's worth noting that it was actually Strieber who penned what eventually became the movie The Day After Tomorrow that talks about sudden climate change and the impacts. Of course, decades later, that book that became that movie is incredibly prescient because we actually have major concerns now that warming in the Atlantic could cause a collapse of the North Atlantic Current, a major premise behind that book. So again, we ask ourselves, is this coincidence or were these beings already ahead of time because they move through time differently than we do? And that's a key point. We'll come back to that later in terms of their potential origin. They use the knowledge they have across time to seed different ideas so that they steer not only the course of individual lives, but perhaps even the entire civilization. We're now going to jump forward to a section of the book where his first hypnotic regression is conducted. We're going to pick it up just after he has seen a light flash in front of the window, and he's very upset by this, very scared by this. Quote, "Relax, close your eyes, relax, you're going to stay relaxed, you're not going to open your eyes. Stay relaxed, now tell us what you saw." "I saw something that looked like it had a hood on it, standing over by the wall near the corner in our bedroom. And I don't want it to be there. I don't want it to be there. Please, God, what's it doing to me? Stop, stop, what's it doing to me?" Screams prolonged for 20 seconds. And Strieber remarks, "I cannot recall experiencing at any time in my life such panic as was evoked at this point in my hypnosis. My memory was of seeing the shape sweeping across the room and realizing with a feeling that galvanized my whole being that it was something totally unknown to me, glaring at me from right beside my bed in the dead of the night. I then emerged spontaneously from hypnosis. No written words, nothing, can convey my feelings at that moment. All I can say is that I relived fear so raw, profound, and large that I would not have thought it possible that such an emotion could exist." He goes on to say, "Oh, I feel like I'm going to throw up in a minute. I'm sorry. Oh, you know, I didn't know there was anything in my house till just this second, that night on the 4th of October." He begins crying. "Jesus. Oh, God. Oh, boy. Scared the devil out of me. Sorry about that. I didn't expect this to be that bad because if I was preparing for being scared on the 26th, I did not know that anything had come into my house. Well, it was there. Can you tell us? You know, it's dark. It's like a little man with a hood on or something. It looks almost like this, you know, there's no head. He's covered in something. And comes over to the bed and he starts like sticking something in. Not into my head, you understand, but like it was sticking into my mind. It would make a noise like a voice. It was terrible. It was just god-awful horrible. He was standing there doing that. What was he doing? You know, I can't. I'd have to be hypnotized again if I was ever going to find out what that thing was saying. It was something that was being said inside me, like it had a little thing it could touch to my head and it would make a voice. That's what I think it was." "While he was talking to you, you weren't shouting then?" "I was shouting. No, I was. I was confused by the question, as will be seen in a moment. The figure was not, in fact, talking to me. I have absolutely no idea why the other people had... I don't remember, because I'm damn sure I was shouting." "Do you remember what your wife was doing?" "I don't see her, because I'm turned toward the thing. Am I still hypnotized?" "No." "I swear to God, I just can't believe that this happened. But it did happen. I'll tell you, the light comes down past the window. Then I see a glow in the front yard. I thought I had gotten up, but I don't think now that I did. I thought I had seen the glow against the roof of the living room, but I don't think that I did. I think I knew all along. It was coming in by the window, the glow, and I just didn't somehow want to say that, because it was very obvious even that it wasn't a fire. And he was, I just don't know what he was doing. And I'll be frank with you all, I just can't figure it out. was very scary, but he wasn't wearing a covery like he had a cover on. I'm shaky. Perfectly understandable. You know, I can't understand it. Yes, I guess of course I understand why an experience like this would be so scary. But you want to keep on? If you'd like to. I do, definitely. Okay. I mean, I think I may have gotten right at the beginning through the worst part of it, frankly. Because whatever it was, when it first came to me that night, it was ultimately terrifying. Bud Hopkins responded, "It's often like this. Beginning moments are the worst, and after that, it gets easier." Unquote. And now we're going to jump a little bit forward where he talks about encountering the specific being and describing that being and what the being is doing to him. Quote, "He's little, goes up to about the top of the lamp, looking down at me, got eyes, big slanted eyes, a bald head. He's looking down at me. He's got a ruler in his hand, has a tip of silver, touches me. I see pictures. I see pictures of the world just blowing up. I see pictures of the whole place just blowing up when he touches my head with this thing. Jesus, it's a picture of like a whole big blast, and there's a dark red fire in the middle of it, and there's white smoke all around it. And the being in my head says, 'That's your home. That's your home. You know why this will happen.'" Struber continues, "I know why." He's weeping. "Why don't you like me? Why do you hate me?" "Who said that?" Dr. Klein asks. "I said that. Why'd you just put that thing on me and it has the whole world blowing up? That's what I want to know. What is this about? What is it about?" Felt a sharp internal question, wordless. "I don't know what it's about. When is this going to blow up? What's going to blow up?" And then the doctor asks him, "Why did he show you those images?" "I don't know why he showed me those images. To be frank with you, they are the most dreadful images. I'll tell you the truth, what I feel. I think he showed me images of the future of our world. That's what he showed me." Unquote. So again, this is why hypnotic regression can be so helpful, because not only can it uncover additional memories, but also adds further context to conscious memories. And we're now going to jump to a section where Struber is beginning to realize that this might go back to his childhood. Quote, "Much later, I listened to the tapes of other people's memories and hypnosis sessions, with their permission, and I read Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time. I then participated in a colloquy with other people who remember being taken. There I found that multiple episode memories are quite commonplace. Many people who report being taken report a lifetime pattern, much like the one I had discovered. I wrestled with the notion that something might have been happening in my life, real encounters, that were having a tremendous, hitherto unconscious effect on me. Certainly I had acted as if this were true before any conscious memories had emerged. The conscious memories didn't really come before the first week in January 1986. Yet as early as the summer of 1985, I had become nervous about people in the house, even to the point of buying expensive burglar alarms and, in October, a shotgun. I even tried to move back to Central Texas, where I grew up. It is interesting to note that I was, if anything, even more fearful in Texas than I was in New York. Did this mean that I unconsciously recalled even more frightening things happening there?" Unquote. And again, this speaks to the fact that he realized that he had had contact experiences even as a child that are recounted in his book, The Secret School, which came later after this book, perhaps a decade later. We're now going to jump to a section of the book where Struber recounts interactions with one particular feminine feeling being. He had ongoing interactions with her, felt a deep bond with this being. And in this particular interaction, he begins to put together that this somehow relates to the fate of the Earth, and this perhaps explains why they would perhaps have the right or the need, the necessity to do what they're doing. This is all recounted in this one section. And I quote, "As I remembered her, I found myself filling with a formless question, groping for what it was that perplexed me. I recalled an exchange that now came to seem very important. I'd had a very distinct impression of her, that she was old. Not just aged, like an elderly person, but really old. Why had I felt this? I could not be sure. I still remember her voice, soft, coming from I know not where, answering me, 'Yes, I'm old.' When she spoke in my head, there was a lilting quality to it. But when she used her voice, it was startlingly deep, to be coming from so slight a creature. It was more than a bass. It sounded like it was booming out from the depths of a cave. I remembered my protest to her when she reassured me about the operation not hurting me. The sense of helplessness was an awful thing to contemplate. "You have no right," I had said. "We do have a right." 5 enormous words, stunning words. "We do have a right." Who gave it to them? By what progress of ethics had they arrived at that conclusion? I wondered if it required debate or seemed so obvious to them that they never questioned it. The fire before me sputtered. I opened the vent on the stove and it obediently flared up again. Maybe their right came from a different direction than one might think. If they were a part of us, it might be that we granted them the right they assert. Listening to the crackle of the fire mingle with the ticking of the clock, I thought that perhaps I might welcome voices of instruction. After finishing Nature's End with James Kunetka, I began to feel strongly that the present world situation was unsustainable. I did not think that the world was actually ending, but I could easily have been persuaded that the biosphere would soon change so catastrophically that an immense amount of human life would be lost. I wondered if a mind contemplating terrors such as this might provide itself with gods, if only to ease the burden of being alone with the fear. If they were real visitors, though, I wanted to know the ethics behind their assertion of their right. Of course, we ourselves barely question our rights over the other species on Earth. How odd it was to find oneself suddenly under the very power that one so easily assumes over the animals. Unquote. Now, let me just take a moment to remind us all of the imminent looming change, either cataclysm or transformation, that I've been discussing on this podcast and on the other podcasts over the last few months. If anything, the words that Stroeber penned decades ago are only all the more relevant in our present day. And indeed, the signs in the world itself, in terms of potential cataclysms in our midst, are only that much more prominent now than they were then. And where there were whisperings and hazy pictures of a potential future then, there is now an all-too-clear picture coming into greater and greater focus of a future of which we stand at the very precipice of. Now, in shifting from the time in human history where Whitley Strieber first penned this novel to the times of today, I want to reflect on an experience I had recently, a series of experiences, actually, that, again, feel very synchronistic. And again, of course, that ties into things I've been talking about on my various podcasts over the last few months, where clearly the synchronicity seems tied to direction that is coming my way. This will make more sense in a second. First thing I want to say is, prior to me going out to Idaho and Montana recently, I had already decided that this book was going to be the focus of the next POC episode. I'd already made my notes and decided which quotes I was going to use and that kind of thing. Then last Wednesday, I flew out to Idaho to prepare for this consciously connected retreat for a group of people who had taken my expanding awareness class. It was a remarkable retreat with a wonderful group of people, and it was an event that I think we will all remember moving forward. Now, after the retreat had concluded, I drove up to Montana to spend some time with my friend Mike Masters. Many of you will know Mike Masters as the chief proponent of the extratempestrial hypothesis. He's a professor at Montana Tech, and he is a biological anthropologist with a specialty in the hominin line. And of course, that becomes central to his role, where he has made the case for the extratempestrial hypothesis, which is his term to describe the fact that these gray aliens might very well be our future progeny, that they are in fact future humans, or as I call them, neo-humans, who represent a further point in the evolutionary trajectory of modern Homo sapiens sapiens. And of course, this ties into, of course, intelligence circles giving information that I discussed on 3 different podcasts a couple of years ago, suggesting that even in those circles, this was understood to be the case, that there were groups of these future humans that were here to address some major event that was about to arise in human history. Now, speaking of that coming future event, one of the many conversations I had with Mike involved he, his wife, and I sitting up on his hillside in his backyard, watching this spectacular sunset over the majestic mountains that surround Butte, Montana. And we were all discussing the state of the world and the sense that it was not difficult to imagine that we were at the precipice of something transformational and potentially something catastrophic, that things cannot carry on as they have been for very much longer. We all had that sense. Now, another one of the conversations that Mike and I had was about our contact experiences. Mike, of course, recounted his experience both at the Enquirer Anomalous Conference, and he also talked about it on a recent Jesse Michaels documentary. And this was the first time that he and I had a chance to discuss our encounters in detail in person. We've been wanting to do this for a couple of years and finally got a chance to. And what was compelling to me, and I think to him as well, was how similar our encounters were and how similar the intelligence we were connected to seemed to be. For instance, we both had a sense that this was a collective intelligence, that they was a better way to describe them than he or she. Now, of course, another remarkably synchronistic tie-in here is that Mike's journey began with this book, with Communion, in many ways, because it was when he was a child and saw his dad's copy of this book with this apparently gray alien, quote-unquote, on the front cover, that he remarked, that being must be related to us somehow. And of course, in retrospect, he understands that that notion, that idea, was seeded to him by this intelligence. And that, of course, began an entire history for him that led into him getting a PhD in this, becoming a world-renowned authority in this area, so that he could make this very case, so that he could begin to make these connections, that these beings are our future descendants, that they themselves are a type of human being, and that in that sense, it absolutely ties into the very things that Whitley was wondering about in his book. How are we connected to them? Have we somehow given them permission because we are all connected somehow? Is this future that it's arising, that they're trying to shape, connected to a better circumstance for them and for us because we are intrinsically connected across time? And isn't it remarkable that my journey began by coming across this book just after finishing high school? And Mike came across this book when he was a child, seeing his dad's copy, and that put him on the path where he went on to become a biological anthropologist who would make this case, and so compellingly so, based on his expert analysis, to the world to shift our understanding about the nature, at least of some of these beings. And I want to add, of course, that when he talked about whether or not he should discuss these things, he got a clear affirmative from them that they wanted him to continue. Indeed, the intervention, you could call it, that they engineered where people channeled information to him was all about their sense of the importance that he continue this work, that he continue to make this case. So again, both of our histories are tied back to this book. Both of our histories are tied to this intelligence that seems very similar, that has guided both of us, that continues to guide us, that we can trace both of our histories back to much earlier points in our lives. And while some people might look at our stories and wonder if we feel a lack of agency, that we've been led all along, we both actually feel, and we talked about this, privileged to be part of a moving consciousness that is beyond us, that we are a part of, but it also transcends us. That provides a sense of meaning and purpose that is deeply compelling, and we both feel that. Now, as if that series of conversations between Mike and I wasn't already profound enough, I had one more experience on my return trip from Idaho back to where I live in North Carolina that really cemented this for me, and it was a remarkably synchronistic experience where I felt like, again, a message was being communicated to me that basically underlined the validity of the extratempestrial hypothesis. Now, again, both Mike and I even discussed the fact that we as human beings in our modern times really still don't understand time. And very often the beings do communicate that we don't understand time, that it functions differently than we understand. But somehow this is in the mix. Time is central to this, and they are in our relative future, certainly. And this prompted me, this experience I had on the plane flying home, to write the following on social media. I said, quote, "I experienced a profound synchronicity while flying home yesterday, related specifically to a conversation I had had with Mike Masters during my trip regarding time travel, the Greys, and the front cover of Strieber's Communion, which was already going to be the topic of this week's POC episode. This was one of those moments that felt unequivocally like a breadcrumb left along my path to help me see the bigger picture," unquote. So what exactly happened? Well, one of the many conversations Mike and I had over those couple of days that we spent together was discussing trends in human physiology, trends around how different people groups across the planet with different ethnicities are evolving differently and how that might relate to the future human hypothesis, where certain people groups seem to mirror those characteristics more than others. Now, we were talking about a specific people group and the commonalities there with the Greys and how that seemed to be the cutting edge of human evolution at this point in time, and that when you also look at the Greys, they most resemble those kinds of characteristics. So you can see a direct line from one to the other, from the most cutting edge of current human evolution to what eventually becomes something that we call a Grey alien. Now, again, there could be events in between, cataclysms, survival of those cataclysms that partly explain the way that they look. But even when we look at current trends of evolution, just follow that along and you eventually get to something like a Grey alien, which is remarkable in itself. But specifically, this one ethnic group is most in line with that trajectory. Now, on my plane ride home, I was reflecting on this, and at one point, there was someone who was bringing the food and the drinks to everyone. Yes, here I'm speaking of a flight attendant who was slowly, row by row, bringing food and drinks to everyone. And because of that, I had a long time to observe this person. And this person also was representative of the ethnic group that Mike and I discussed in terms of the cutting edge of human evolution and how that can be followed along a line towards what eventually becomes something like a Grey alien. And in that moment, I had this kind of overlay in my mind that helped me connect some dots. And it was having brought to my attention, piece by piece, elements of this person's physiology that when traced along a direct line will eventually become what we consider a Grey alien. So the synchronicity was around the fact that I saw a person who represented the very kind of ethnic background that Mike and I have been discussing. And in this overlay, mentally, I was shown how that relates directly to who these beings become in the future. These beings that, again, colloquially we've referred to as Grey aliens. And not only did I get a chance to see this person in a fleeting moment, but I saw this person over about 20 minutes where I could study them and where this overlay was happening in real time because they were moving slowly up the plane aisle, going from row to row to row. And I knew in that moment that was a direct connection to the conversation we'd had earlier, which ties into this entire stream of synchronicity that has been part of my life over the last months and years, tracing back, you could say, to my very early childhood. And again, Mike can also point to that kind of trajectory in his own life. And over these couple of days we spent together, this kind of intersected and I think helped provide clarity and a sense of peace about the entire thing, because both of us also have this overarching sense that these beings, the beings that are contacting us, that represent the furthest reach of evolution that perhaps we've encountered, are very good beings. They're benevolent. They are the prototypical love and light kind of beings. That's been our experience, both of us. And knowing that they are in charge, that they are trying to mitigate and help navigate this transition in human history, makes us feel better about the entire thing. And again, makes us feel privileged to feel like we are playing a role in that entire enterprise, an enterprise that ultimately stretches across time and space and that fundamentally impacts all of us. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. or by subscribing on Spotify. Until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.